Well, welcome back, everyone. We've now had a very stimulating keynote speaker to start us off, and a first panel comprehensively looking at transparency thus far, what needs to be done, what has been done, and room for improvement, to be sure. And now we're going to focus on a particular angle with respect to transparency initiatives and improvement and implementation. What we try to do here at CGS, this is now our fourth program during the Obama administration on information policy, we try to cover things from different angles as time goes by. And it occurred to me this year that something relatively new has cropped up in the last year with respect to openness in government policy and implementation, and that has to do with increasing budget constraints. Now, that's nothing new in the federal government. To be sure, we've been running a deficit for years and years and years. But it seems that lately that has posed a very distinct threat to the potential implementation of aspirations of the administration and those outside of the administration. And when I called Sean Moulton, our panel moderator, Sean immediately said, yes, we're concerned about that at OMB Watch. And I know Gary Bass is concerned about that sort of thing as well. Gary has moved on to be executive director of the Bauman Family Foundation. And Sean said, I think I could moderate a panel, and what I can do is I can get Gary, I think, to come and be part of it. Sean said something to the effect that he had enough blackmail on Gary from his days at OMB Watch that he could very easily get him, and then we're lucky to have other panelists. So what I'll do is just introduce Sean as your moderator. He's the director of Federal Information Policy, and he's become a very weighty leader in this area over the last 3 or 4 years, to be sure. And I know that was not that sort of a reference, Sean. People in glass houses don't throw stones, or tin houses don't throw can openers either. And then Sean will introduce the other members, and I'll leave you in his very capable hands.
Thank you. So we are going to be discussing the resource question when it comes to open government, but we're going to, I guess, break a little bit with our assigned topic and broaden the discussion as well, not just about the budget constraint and its impact, but our speakers will be talking about the cost of secrecy, the cost and resources necessary to participate in open government from the outside perspective as well. And so it's not just whether or not we're getting enough bucks from government or if they're going to the right things, but also what's going on in terms of the resource equation on the outside. Is it becoming cheaper? Is it becoming more expensive? Is it staying the same? So I'm going to go through our panelists, give a brief introduction of all of them before we'll start off. First, Daniel Schumann, who's the policy counsel and director of the Advisory Committee on Transparency over at the Sunlight Foundation, is with us. Many of you probably know Daniel from his work at the Sunlight Foundation. In particular, the work that he's here to talk about is they led the charge defending the e-government fund from some pretty drastic cuts that were initially proposed in Congress, and Daniel really coordinated a lot of us to push back on that. Then we're going to have Elizabeth Goitin, who directs the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Project, their role is really to make sure that people's civil liberties are being protected while the government engages in its war on terrorism and other activities, and that includes a particular focus on government secrecy and privacy rights. Elizabeth is just back from a trip to Guantanamo, which is a real eye-opening experience, I think, when it comes to government secrecy. Then we have Lucy Dalglish, who's the executive director of the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of Press. She's been there since 2000. She's got a lot of years behind her as a reporter and and as a FOIA advocate. I really can't think of anyone that I know that I feel knows more about FOIA in the United States at the state level and the national level, especially from the perspective of outside requesters. And finally, we have Gary Bass, who was a longtime mentor to me while he was executive director at OMB Watch. He founded it back in 1983 and just recently moved on from that position to be, as Dan mentioned, executive director of the Bauman Family Foundation. But he's extremely knowledgeable when it comes to right to information, government transparency and openness, as well as a lot of budget fights, which is a good meeting point for our discussion today. So I'm going to hand it over to Daniel. I'm going to save some of my questions for the end, but I've kind of set it up that we're approaching this from a variety of perspectives, and so I'm going to hand it over to Daniel to hear about the congressional or the perspective of funding open government in Congress.
Well, thank you so much. I'm going to start at the 30,000-foot perspective and slowly work my way to the ground, hopefully not hitting it too quickly. So in the 1993 movie Dave, Charles Grodin plays a CPA advising presidential imposter Kevin Kline, who's trying to redirect government funding to save a cherished social program. While reviewing the federal budget, Grodin says, "I've been over this stuff a dozen times. It just doesn't add up. Who does these books? I mean, if I ran my business this way, I'd be out of business." Well, it doesn't necessarily make sense to run the government like a business. Grodin does have something right. It's really hard to make sense of how the government spends money. The people at the top have only a hazy idea of how much money is actually spent and must go through intermediaries to get at the raw numbers. The people at the bottom must respond to often contradictory directives that appear to undermine their mission, even as it changes underneath their feet for often mysterious reasons. And the people in the middle have to keep everyone happy, while making sure that too much information doesn't make it from the top to the bottom, or vice versa. These perversities are just the start. The bifurcation of the budgeting process between the executive and legislative branches results in a game of cat and mouse where agencies must publicly follow the White House's line while quietly undermining it. At one time, agencies were able to talk directly to Congress about their budget requests, but that practice ended with a set of reforms that also created the president's budget, which was an attempt to rationalize the process. In the 1970s, another round of reforms tried to claw back power to Congress so that the legislative branch could set the budgetary agenda, but these reforms instead created an even more broken process where the Congress continually fails to pass a budget resolution and often relies on continuing resolution after continuing resolution to keep the government open. And at the same time, each branch keeps its own set of contradictory books, jealously guarding information from one another and from the public. And even worse than all that, appropriators in the legislative branch refuse to make available appropriations bills until they've passed out of committee, which serves to empower the special interests that have their hooks into the appropriators while weakening public scrutiny until it's too late to affect the process. I hope I haven't depressed you. Sorry. I'm going to make it worse. So what information is available to the public is often untrustworthy. A sunlight analysis of how the federal government reports its spending, available at clearspending.org, found $1.3 trillion in broken reporting in 2011. While it's important that budget information is released, it should also be consistent, timely, and accurate. And the real losers in this budget process, besides, of course, all of us who believe that decisions should reflect policy goals and not political power, are the programs that lack a strongly defined and politically active constituency. There's always money for fighter planes and highways, but important programs that have diffuse beneficiaries or weak advocates are the first on the chopping block when times get tight or a number needs to be balanced. This is true even when better methods, such as publicly displaying accurate budget data in concert with performance data, help make the government more effective and efficient. Gesundheit. Former federal CIO Vivek Kundra, for example, created a dashboard to monitor federal information technology spending, which comes in at around $80 billion annually at the website itdashboard.gov. In addition to providing a useful interface to access, evaluate, and download spending data, it displays a straightforward graphic that shows whether a program is on schedule, whether it's at cost, and it identifies the staffer responsible for the program, including publishing his or her photograph. Kundra claims that the dashboard helped the government save $3 billion, by eliminating some projects, changing the scope on others, and accelerating timelines on still more. In short, transparency helped improve government management and contain costs. And yet this program and a number of other initiatives came under threat in the last two budget cycles. The Electronic Government Fund that Sean mentioned in his opening remarks, which supports programs like the IT Spending Dashboard, federal grant and contract spending at usaspending.gov, and data.gov, where nearly 400,000 government data sets are published online, faced extinction at the hands of Congress in the beginning of 2011. It's only happenstance that I discovered this problem. The open government community is neither structured nor engaged in fights over funding for particular programs. Instead, most of us, not all, but most of us focus on the broad policy issues. In this case, I happen to be looking at the budget passed by the House of Representatives for something else entirely, and notice that the fund was cut from $34 million to $2 million, which would, in effect, kill all of these transparency programs. The only reason these changes hadn't been enacted was because the House and Senate couldn't agree on unrelated budget issues. I was blogged about the issue, and I called it at the time a budget technopocalypse, which is not easy to say. In the ensuing months, Sunlight and a number of organizations, including OMB Watch, a number of other partner organizations, leading technology authorities like the creator of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, boy, that's a tongue twister, 10,000 citizens, and many others rallied behind a campaign to save the data. We were able to make allies with members of Congress who had been unaware of the appropriation shortfall. Staff changes in both houses of Congress meant that appropriators were in the lead on this issue, and the appropriators either didn't know what these transparency programs did or weren't interested in having budget information being made available to the public in the first place. Ultimately, we were able to restore funding to $8 million for fiscal year 2011, which was enough to keep core programs alive, albeit on life support, and a few programs were canceled. We renewed the fight again for fiscal year 2012, and with the help of leaders in Congress and others who understand the transformative nature of online transparency, we were able to restore funding to $12.4 million, including fighting off an attempt to kill these programs by combining the EGA fund with another funding stream, which would have ended their dedicated source of money, and we would have ended up with sort of a shell game where the money would have been shifted around and basically would have disappeared. Now, $12.4 million is a far cry from the $34 million appropriated for the EGA fund in 2009 and 2010, but it is enough to keep these programs alive and allow some innovations to occur, albeit at a slower rate. I think two major lessons can be drawn from this. Well, let me rephrase. I'm drawing two major lessons. I'm sure that there are others that can be drawn as well. First, even for someone who's relatively informed about the workings of Congress, it is hard and sometimes impossible to find out what's going on in the budget world. Much of the appropriations process is deliberately cloaked in secrecy, and the information that is disclosed to the public is often imprecise, incomplete, difficult to find, and hard to use. That's why we need good, trackable data on the federal appropriations process to empower advocates and the public to see what's going on. It's also why we need a website like budget.gov where all of this information from across the different branches can be found in one place. Now, there are some legislative programs or proposals to address these issues, the most notable of which is the Data Act, which was introduced in the House by Chairman Issa and in the Senate by Senator Warner. This bill wouldn't address all these problems, but it does address two pieces of it. The first thing that it does is create an independent board along the lines of the RAC board. This is cleverly enough called the FAST board, that would publish and monitor federal spending and make it available so that we can all see it. Now, this doesn't cover all the things I'm talking about, but it covers a lot of them. The second thing that it does, and this is also painfully common sense, is that it says that agencies must follow government-wide data standards so their data sets can talk to one another, so that you can roll up information from you know, every penny spent all the way to the agency, to the department, to the federal level. So this is the first lesson. Legislation like this, these kinds of initiatives, makes a lot of sense. The second lesson that I would suggest is that rapid turnover in congressional staff means that legislative expertise is ephemeral and yesterday's allies can easily disappear. If we don't keep a close eye on what's going on in Congress, especially with respect to budgeting, the ongoing brain drain will mean that important programs will either be killed out of ignorance or as a consequence of turf wars between the Appropriations Committee and just about everyone else. Information about the budget, from when it's proposed in the President's budget to when it's considered by Congress to when it's spent by the agencies, should be available online, in real time, and in a machine-readable format. Only this kind of transparency can empower legislators, agency staff, and the public to make sure that the federal budget reflects America's true priorities. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Daniel. And now Liza's going to talk a bit about, again, we're going to deviate a little bit from our topic, and Liza's going to talk about the sort of the opposite side of the coin, but the cost of secrecy and the cost of not being more open and investing better in our open government process.
Sorry about that. Thanks to Dan, wherever he is, for there he is, for putting this event together and for inviting me to be on the panel. Sean, I actually don't think that I'm deviating from the topic of this panel, which is has to do with the costs of transparency, because the costs of secrecy are the other side of the ledger, and you can't evaluate or even understand the costs of transparency without comparing those costs against the cost of the alternative, which is the cost of keeping as many secrets as we do. So I'm going to talk about some of those costs, the cost of secrecy, today. I'll start with the known costs of the security classification system, namely the costs associated with managing and protecting classified information. The Information Security Oversight Office reported in fiscal year 2010 that agencies spent a little over $10 billion on security classification. To give you a comparison point and a sense of how else this money might be spent, that was roughly the budget of the Environmental Protection Agency for that same year, and it was twice the budget of the National Cancer Institute. This number doesn't really begin to capture the cost of government secrecy for a couple of reasons. First, classification is obviously only one aspect of government secrecy. There's also the cost of protecting information that isn't classified, sensitive, unclassified information, things like that. There are the costs of litigating state secrets privileges, litigating FOIA exemptions, prosecuting whistleblowers, as Amy was talking about. And then there are the costs associated with secrecy measures that can't really or that aren't really characterized as information security, things like designing and building surveillance drones that are too small to be detected. So that there are a whole bunch of costs that aren't in that number. And even with respect to simply classification, that number is incomplete because there are some agencies that classify their classification budgets. Apparently, Al-Qaeda doesn't care what the FBI or the State Department or the Department of Homeland Security spend on their classification budgets, but they are dying to know the classification budgets of the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the National Reconnaissance Office, and the National Security Agency. Of course, these agencies are some of the major players when it comes to dealing in secret information. So the actual cost of classification is probably several times the $10 billion that we know about. So what sorts of things fall under this price tag? Well, of course, there's the cost of securing the information itself. Part of that is physical security, things like building and maintaining the structures, the physical structures, the rooms, the locked file cabinets in which classified information is stored, facilities in which classified information can be viewed. And part of it is information system security, which is essentially establishing and maintaining secure computer networks and communication systems and protecting against unauthorized closure. Altogether, these measures cost around $6.1 billion in 2010. Let me give you a specific example of how information security can affect government spending. And I'm going to use an old statistic, I'm afraid, because I couldn't find the more updated one. But in 1993, the cost of a five-drawer, legal-sized filing cabinet for storing unclassified information, locked, was $174.17. The cost of a five-drawer, legal-sized filing cabinet outfitted to store classified information was $2,110. $2,160. So that's a difference of an order of magnitude and then some. And I'd actually like to urge all of you, if you haven't already done so, to read Dana Priest's book, Top Secret America, which gives a visceral sense of how overwhelmingly huge and expensive the physical infrastructure of security has become in this country. There's also the cost of processing clearances for people to actually see this information. For each person who is ultimately granted access to classified information, there first has to be an extensive and expensive background check by the government. As the amount of classified information that permeates the government grows and grows, so does the number of individuals who need clearances in order to do their jobs. As a result, we now have more than 4.2 million people in this country who have a security clearance. That's about the same size as the federal government. It's also roughly 1 in 50 American adults. When the government is conducting extensive background checks on 1 in every 50 American adults, it's expensive. That was about $1.6 billion in 2010. Then there's the cost of declassification. Now, on its surface, that may look like a cost of transparency, but of course, if a document is never classified, it never has to be declassified. So it's actually an indirect and quite significant cost of secrecy. The good news, from a cost perspective, is that we're not spending nearly enough resources to make a real dent in the several hundred million page backlog or document backlog of documents awaiting declassification at the National Archives. But in this case, not nearly enough still adds up to over $50 million in 2010. There's one final cost that I want to mention, which is nowhere in this $10 billion or, you know, several times $10 billion or whatever it is. And that's the cost of bad decisions, which is what you get when you have executive officials, not always, but what you often get when you have executive officials who make important decisions in secret without the informed input of other members of the executive branch, of Congress, and of the public. You can't always put a dollar number on that, but sometimes you can. When the executive branch made its case for war in Iraq, it classified and withheld some information that powerfully undermined its case for war. The price tag for that war was $800 billion, just the financial price tag, of course. Would that have been spent? Would that have been a cost we incurred if the government had been more transparent about its information? Maybe, maybe not. It would be one thing if all of these costs that I've mentioned were justified by national security considerations. First of all, that wouldn't change the narrow point I'm making here, which is that government secrecy is more expensive than transparency. And also, it's not the case. You know, certainly, some information absolutely needs to be classified and protected from disclosure. But officials from across the political spectrum, from all administrations, have acknowledged for years that we classify far too much information, and they've given estimates of anywhere from 50 to 90% of classified documents that could be safely released. So this is money, lots of money, that we're spending unnecessarily. I don't want to sound naive about the ability to save money by reversing the secrecy trend. Some of the costs that I've mentioned are sunk costs. Others, things like computer security, for example, computer network security, are not highly volume dependent, so you can cut back on the amount of classified information that flows through a network, and it's not necessarily going to make much of a difference in how much you have to spend to maintain that network. And of course, there will have to be some kind of upfront costs to opening the government before you start to see savings, at least in some contexts. And the example I would give is the Fundamental Classification Guidance Review, which is happening now, where agencies have been directed by the administration to revisit their classification guides through a process that, if done correctly, should take a fair amount of time and resources. Still, given how much it's costing us to maintain the current and excessive level of government secrecy, I really think the question that this panel should be addressing is not so much can we afford to make government more open, but can we afford not to?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. Next, we're going to turn to Lucy, and we will get, I guess, another aspect of this discussion where we'll talk about the resource hurdles that requesters continue to face.
Thanks, Sean. As always, it's a pleasure to be here. And as always, I come to these meetings and I basically have a game of ping pong going on inside my head when I listen to everybody, and everything I was thinking about saying kind of goes out the window and I'm squiggling out notes and crossing out things I intended to say. I think I've decided today to try to, this is a very Washington-centric conversation. I get some phone calls from Washington reporters. The Reporters Committee does legal defense and advocacy work and FOI work for journalists working all over the United States. We take questions from state questions, federal questions. We deal with journalists broadly defined, so we get a lot of phone calls from independent journalists who have their own blogs and whatnot. And I'm going to try to look at this from what the rest of the folks in the United States are seeing when they look at this and what some of the costs are. And from my constituency, what journalists are dealing with. You know, the budgets for managing federal information, obviously, you know, being threatened, it's a huge disappointment. Times are tough. You're not spending as much. Yes, would it be easier if you released all of this information? And all that is kind of, you know, up here at this level. Traditionally, what you probably instinctively know is that outside of a handful of Washington and New York and other nonprofit organizations that have diligently challenged government secrecy over the years, most of the lawsuits nationwide, if you were to go back 40 years or since 1966, most of the lawsuits brought regarding the Freedom of Information Act and other laws were brought by local newspapers. And those folks spent an enormous amount of money trying to pry information out of the government, not just the federal government, but the state government. And if you think the federal government's having financial trouble, look at the news business. And anybody here who has been working for a news organization of any sort knows what kind of a meltdown we're having. When, and all of you folks who are government employees, not just state, not just federal, but on the states as well, you all know we're broke. And you all know we're not going to file those lawsuits. And I'm having phone calls from reporters out in the states saying, what can we do here? You know, I had a very interesting conversation with the editor of the Arizona Daily Star a week or so ago, and I'm going to mention that again a little bit later. But she was saying, yeah, here in Arizona, we're not getting anything because they know we're not going to sue them. They just know it. We can't afford it, and they know it. Now, the amendments to federal FOIA a few years ago, the most recent amendments that finally loosened up fee shifting so make that it makes it more of a possibility that your legal fees will be reimbursed if you have to sue. That's helpful, but let me tell you, these folks are still so gun-shy, and the notion that that might not be covered has just really paralyzed them, and you all know it. The other thing is I go conversation after conversation here in Washington, and I talk to all of these folks who are working in the agencies, and they are so excited about technology, and they're so excited about posting this data set and that data set. And boy, you know, won't business be able to make a lot of money if they're able to use this government information? The economy will really get a boost and all of that. And that's really wonderful. But what folks that I'm dealing with use that information for is largely oversight. Oversight and investigation. They're checking things out when something, they perceive there's an issue. They get a tip about something that might not be going right. And they don't necessarily, some reporters do have incredible uses for data sets. But a lot of them are also looking for something fairly isolated. I've been told this. How do I find that out? And they are still being smacked down on a regular basis. On the local level, what this has meant is they've just stopped asking. They've just, you know, I've got reporters who've said, you know, I use my state FOI law every day. You know, I go in there, I use it. I stopped asking for federal information years ago. I'm a newspaper. I have a deadline. I can't wait 7 years. So they try to figure out other ways to do the same story. There are a couple of examples. Josh Gerstein mentioned one of them this morning that I just kind of want to give you an idea of what those costs work out to be like. About a year ago, we knew that the Guantanamo commissions were going to be coming up, and Josh could not be more accurate when he talks about how confusing it is for me to explain to a reporter who calls in and says, okay, I want to cover the military commissions. So it's a federal court proceeding, right? It's like, no, it's not. They all know federal court proceedings are public proceedings. Military commissions, the position of the Defense Department is that that's an administrative proceeding. FOIA is really going to apply, and you are in kind of this la-la land over there. As a result, with the military commissions, a lot of there's a sort of a media coalition. We got together. We hired an expensive lawyer to just go in and start negotiating. So any access we have worked out to those pooled closed-circuit feeds at Fort Meade and everything, it's because we spent a lot of money negotiating with the Pentagon to do something that, quite honestly, I believe they should have been doing anyway. But you have to go in there and just keep after them all the time, and it's expensive. And I don't know if we're going to be able to do that again. There are a couple of other things that reporters in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, just flat out don't get. And a lot of it has to do with the way the federal government handles privacy compared to the way all of the states handle privacy issues. I'll give you two examples. Getting back to the editor of the Arizona Daily Star, we were having a conversation about how in the aftermath of the Gabrielle Giffords, Judge John Rollins shooting in Tucson, how they felt that they had been transported to another planet because the local cops grabbed Jared Loughner, took him to Pima County, took his picture, followed the law, distributed his mugshot. Then the feds swoop in, grab him. They go, okay, can we have his federal mugshot? No. Why? He's in the Ninth Circuit. It's like, so what? Well, they got a lesson in federal privacy law. Those, some of you who deal with this every day, well, journalists deal with this every day. There is a real problem with the law when it comes to mugshots. The only place those mugshots are public is in the Sixth Circuit because of a case called Detroit Free Press about 20 years ago. So the Marshal Service goes to the judge, the federal judge presiding over the Loughner case, saying, tell us whether or not we have to release these mugshots. And he's going, well, you've got to deny it before I have an issue in front of me. What are you doing? Well, what the major media have figured out is they have a Sixth Circuit workaround. They have people set up in Detroit and Nashville who will make the request out of the Sixth Circuit. So they call the Marshal Service, which is up by my office in Arlington. They call and they say, we want the mugshot that is in Tucson. Because the request came from the Sixth Circuit, that is now public. Once it's public, they have to distribute it nationwide. And you've got these folks in Arizona going, what? And they're calling me, and I'm going, yeah, I know. It's crazy. Now, this is something the major media can work around, but there's a case that's being considered that's being conferenced today at the Supreme Court called Karrant Salas. And this man is a blogger from Florida. He wanted a mugshot of a convicted felon who had been on the most wanted list and whose the feds had been circulating his photo forever. He's in prison. He wants the official prison photograph, and they say no to him. He's in the 11th Circuit. The 11th Circuit said no. He said, I can't afford to just keep going to the Sixth Circuit and finding somebody on a contract to do this. Now, we're waiting to see how this plays out. He's done this pro se. Obviously, if the Supreme Court takes it, the media is all going to jump on it and everything. If they don't, what's really curious about the pleadings in that case, or the government's response to his petition for cert, is that there's kind of a threat in there. Regardless of what you do, we're no longer going to honor the Sixth Circuit. In effect, this is what they're saying. We're no longer going to honor the Sixth Circuit precedent. So they basically picked a fight. I'm really curious to see what's going to happen next week. But from the outside looking in, they're going, what in the world is the big deal? And besides that, what's the privacy interest? This guy was convicted. Then perhaps where I get the most questions lately have to do from healthcare journalists. A really good example of how government data sets were used and how ProPublica spent an enormous amount of money on lawyers freeing up some databases. They did not want to know the names of any individual patients. They did not want to know the names of any individual doctors. But they had heard, you may not know, that dialysis programs across the country are run by, really there's maybe five big providers, and all dialysis services are basically federalized. It's a Medicaid program. They were able, after 2.5 years of fighting over this stuff, to get a database that they were able to do an incredible story about that showed if you lived in Brooklyn and were going to one of these two dialysis centers, you had a far better rate, far better chance of surviving than when you went to one of these two clinics in the Upper West Side. Now, how is that not in the public's interest? And what I don't understand is some of this stuff would just not be expensive to release. Some of this stuff is fairly simple, and I don't quite understand how the Obama directive from day number two in office didn't filter down to some of this stuff. It still boggles my mind. I'm going to kind of just leave two departing shots. Will Ferrajaro mentioned the OGIS report that was hung up at the Office of Management and Budget, right? Miriam and her staff are on there trying to do these really, really great things. Congress has ordered them to report. It goes to OMB and it just sort of sits there. Some kind of game is going on and I don't know what it is. I'm really, really curious. I just don't get it. If the stated objective from the White House is we're going to be information friendly, what's going on here? And finally, the government may be having a hard time processing a lot of FOIA requests and prioritizing and all of that. But I tell you one thing they are spending money on, and if this sounds gratuitous, I apologize, but I have been told, based on a conference I went to recently with a bunch of intelligence folks, where I was told point blank, you know, Lucy, you really won't have to worry about reporters getting subpoenaed anymore for these whistleblower cases or these leaker cases, because we now have the technology. We know who you're talking to. We don't need to subpoena you anymore. We know who you're spending money on. We track your credit cards. We track your airplane tickets. We track all of this stuff. So don't worry about those subpoenas anymore. We know who you got. And apparently there's money out there to do that. So anyway, thank you for inviting me. I know those thoughts were all rather random, but I mostly was responding to all the interesting things everybody else was saying this morning, so thanks.
Well, thank you. And I think, actually, your comment toward the end there about the Obama directive and it getting down there and this is easy, why is it not happening? I think Gary will be speaking quite a bit to some of that in his comments, so I'm gonna hand it off to him.
Thanks, Grasshopper. listening to this panel, I guess the first thing I was thinking of is the quote, money isn't everything, it's just most everything. Yeah. And I think that's probably ultimately what I'm going to conclude is the wrong focus. I think that Daniel is right. You know, the budget is opaque. It's a problem. But there's also a much more fundamental problem going on the budget, and that's an ideological split in this country around government spending, role of government. It exists at the state level. It exists at the federal level. And we pay the consequence because you have gridlock when you have that ideological divide. And that gridlock often means, at least at the federal level, less spending because you have less revenue. So there are issues around spending cuts. They've gone on for years and years and years, as Dan Metcalf said when he was introducing this panel. I suppose all of us who have tracked transparency issues over the years would feel like, oh, we've got to do more with less. It's always been that way. And, of course, the ultimate of doing more with less is doing everything with nothing, which can't be done, right? So ultimately, we have to look at money issues. But money is not everything. I think Liza does an excellent job of demonstrating where we're spending money. One thing you didn't mention, Liza, is if you took your $10.2 billion figure and go back to, say, 1999 and adjust for inflation, that's 107% increase over that time frame. So we're spending more, a lot more, on the process of classifying, excluding the agencies you mentioned that we don't know. So it isn't about spending sometimes. It's sometimes spending on the wrong things. Or for that matter, it could be we probably, everyone in this room could come up with their example of waste, of where government spent money on even a transparency effort that was just wasteful. We could also come up with areas where, as Daniel described on the e-government fund, inevitably, without money, we can't get some things done. We can't expand them. We can't improve on them. So I don't want to start off with the notion that money is everything. I think that there are some bigger issues. Money is important, but it is not sufficient to simply call for more money. The second thing I want to raise is that when we bemoan budget cuts, we don't even really have any sense of what we're bemoaning about. So I'm going to do a little homework assignment for all of you. I want you to write down, or put it in your head if you don't have pen and paper, how much money you think is being spent on government openness. We'll take FY10 since that's the last year. How much is spent? Okay. Anybody got a number they want to throw out? Give me a number. How much? What did you write down over here? Got a number? 500 million. Okay. Anybody, and anybody else? Come on, we got to do it. Yeah. How much? 100 million. Okay. Anybody else? Yeah.
If you include government PR and openness, you have a very large budget. It's well into the hundreds of millions and possibly billions.
Okay.
Advertising and all sorts of things. That's traditionally not how we bring openness.
Well,
the big money is.
We certainly know, and Miriam, you can check me if I'm wrong, the annual reports from FOIA say a little over $400 million for the last fiscal year we have the full numbers for. And actually, it's been increasing with inflation, even when you adjust for inflation. So some of those numbers are going to be way too low. Maybe your number is higher. Miriam?
And that's just for FOIA administration.
Right.
That's not all openness. Good. Or changing the openness.
Well, that's actually where I was headed is, you know, we could take your definition. The problem is we don't even have a definition of what openness includes. So how do we even talk about this budget issue? We don't even have a metric to say whether budgets are going up or going down in terms of openness. And then we have to have the countervailing that Liza raised, which is There's also spending for, if you will, counter openness. How do we weave that in? So I'm not in a position as a budget wonk to be here to say, oh, isn't it terrible what's happening to us? Because I don't know. I really don't know. So, okay, we need a metric, obviously, and we need someone or a group of folks to start us down this path to better understand how much our government is spending on openness, and is that good spending or bad spending? We don't have that. And, you know, I'm really thankful that OpenTheGovernment.org does do its secrecy report, because a lot of the numbers, you know, are aggregated in that report. But maybe that's the place, and I see Patrice sitting there, maybe that's the place we should start this process of thinking about a metric for what overall spending is and start getting a barometer of whether we're going up or down and whether that's good or bad spending. Okay. And I want to now turn to, okay, so we've got a problem. We don't even know what we're talking about. That's a not a good way to have a panel, but... Then I want to turn to what Daniel pointed out, which is a complete acknowledgement. We as a community who care about transparency are not even well structured to fight for more money. We're very skilled, and Lucy just took us down some very intricate, detailed, and important legal issues. We're very skilled in working the authorizing committees in Congress, and for that matter, state houses. And we need to be better at that. But as a community, we're not well structured to address the appropriations process. And in fact, most of us probably don't understand the process that Daniel started us out describing at that 10,000-foot level. So if we want to first get a metric on what is open spending, or open we want open spending too, don't we? But open government, we also have to have the ability to influence it. And that brings me to the heart of my comments, which is I'm willing to stipulate that we need to do more to raise money for these kinds of programs when necessary, and we have to do a better job at it. But frankly, I think the discussion today should not be so much about funding constraints as much as the heart of the problem is how do we get the agency implementation for the policies that are already put in place? Or how do we address the policy gaps that are also still not being addressed? Those are the key problems. And I can tell you from personal experience, when the government wants to do something, they can get it done. I was involved in the USAspending.gov that Daniel mentioned. There was no money line itemed by Congress to build the website around how much government spends. It was a commitment on the part of the Bush administration to carry out that Coburn Obama law and get it done. And so they spent the money. Regulations.gov has no line item. In fact, OMB forces agencies to pony up for it. When there's a commitment, it will get done. I've been in meetings with the White House staff, some in this room, in fact, where we have talked about the importance of getting something like ethics.gov done. The limitations are not necessarily money. It is how to get it done. And that's where our energy should be really aiming at, is how to get these things done. There are a ton of policy gaps that still exist in my mind that we should be addressing. On my list, you all have your own list, but reading the newspaper today, I want more disclosure on the super PACs that are going on. I can't wait until, you know, some other point after key points of discovering. I'd like to see, in light of what Lucy was talking about, I'd like to see privacy lifted on tax expenditures. I want to know about that form of spending. You know, some states already do that. I mean, every one of us would have our list of policy gaps that still exist, and we should get focused on those. And we have to address the National Security Archive motto, which is the flotilla. That's it. Yeah. That's Nate, I guess, and your boss, Tom Blanton, talking about this problem of how do we get agencies to move. Okay, let me conclude by just saying I would be remiss, however, to talk about a funding crunch in a slightly different way. and that is I'm now wearing a hat as head of a foundation that gives out money. It is shocking to me that when I go to look at philanthropic giving in the United States for the last full year, which is also 2010 where the numbers exist, we're talking roughly in the neighborhood of $29.1 billion in giving. I'd like to just see even 1% for transparency issues. The infrastructure of money going to groups that are working on transparency is woeful. And since 2008, foundation giving, which is one piece of that philanthropic giving, has actually been on the decline. We're hitting a period where there's a huge crunch, and it's harder to raise money for the groups who are doing this work around making government more open. If we do not have an infrastructure of organizations throughout the states and at the national level that are working on this kind of advocacy for more spending or better spending or for better policies, we will fail in the long run. To me, the solution, a key part of the solution around government openness, is to have the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, well-funded and moving forward. So if there is a funding constraint that I'm familiar with right now, it's the inadequate ability of foundations to fund this. To wrap up, my 4 points. We've got to beef up advocacy on government spending, no question. 2, we've got to identify how much money is being spent and what kind of thing we want. 3, we've got to focus on the policy implementation on what we've got, and we've got to push for more. And finally, we all have to educate those who give money through philanthropic agendas about the importance of government openness. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Gary. And I'm glad, as you said before the panel, you said, I don't have much really to say. And you really stuck to that. I appreciate that. That is what working for Gary was like. So to summarize here, and again, I guess similar to Daniel's opening comments, I don't want to depress us too much, but how much we're spending on open government is pretty unclear, but we're pretty certain it's not nearly enough. It's way too low. Secrecy is tremendously expensive and going up all the time. The struggle to get information out of government, that cost remains high. But media is broke, and foundations are giving less. So it doesn't seem to be a very positive dynamic. We have a lot of good policy coming out, and implementation of that policy is inconsistent. And we don't even think if we got the money, at least this is one of the things Gary said, it's not even about the money. That's only a component. So it's not a very good dynamic. I do want to, if people are interested, I'd like to ask people to come to the microphones and ask questions. I do have one question I want to ask the panel. There's been a lot of discussion about this lack of clarity on how much we're spending. And I want to, it's a two-part question. One is, who's responsible for changing that dynamic? I mean, does it have to be an administration that decides to start breaking it out and doing it differently? Does it have to be that Congress tasks one of the appropriations committees with putting this as a separate item? Where is the pressure for those groups that are working on this? Where do we leverage that to say, you need to start creating this transparency, this clarity, this metric? And second, even if we got that metric, Daniel and Gary both talked about the problem with the community and its structure, the diffuse beneficiaries. Can we really use that? I mean, or do we need to change how it is open government groups are working right now? Even if we got that information, could we make good use of it? Is there an audience out there that would fight for these funds to go up? I'll leave it open to anyone.
So there's a couple of pieces to that. So the first one as to who does this, it's whoever we can talk into doing it. I mean, one of the first things that I would look for and that I do look for is where are the built-in institutional dynamics that are creating sort of friction? So, you know, the appropriators want to keep it to themselves, so talk to the oversight committees, because the oversight committees need this information to do their work, and, you know, everyone in Congress is always happy to stick a knife in everybody else. So there might be an opportunity to talk to other folks within there who are willing to work at it. Or there may be, you know, one of the cardinals, one of the appropriation subcommittees who believes in this kind of stuff, and that person might be willing to push things forward. So there's that. You can do pilots within particular agencies. You can try to use overarching entities within the federal government. The eGov administrator is a good place to start for looking at, you know, sort of gathering data together. There's many different sort of places where we can sort of get into the process. And of course, you know, if people aren't willing to do transparency, we can help do transparency to them. You give me that expression, but that you know, oftentimes what's helpful is to take the data that's available, use it as a lever to demonstrate both where the information is strong and where it's weak, and use the weakness to go and create a media story around it that in turn leverages back into fixing the process. We've seen that, for example, with clear spending, which was a way of trying to fix federal reporting. The other piece, I don't have a great solution to the great nonprofit funding crisis that we seem to be dealing with, but what I would suggest is there is a need, while we still have the capacity to advocate on policy issues, to do a little bit of empire building of our own. So, for example, the Data Act would create an entity that's funded by the federal government to address data quality and consistencies and transparency concerns. So it doesn't have to come from our pockets. It can come from the government's pocket. There's the Public Online Information Act, which does the same kind of thing, tries to create some sort of a coordinating entity across the three branches of government. We've got OGIS, who is playing a coordinating role in these kinds of places and certainly needs more funding and more authority to do the work that they're doing. And there's other folks. You know, the eGov administrator is another piece of this. There are places inside government, whether it's legislative branch, whether it's legislative support agencies, whether it's the executive branch or the independent agency. There's lots of places to build these kinds of things so that, you know, we spend, what was it? It was $10 billion or more on creating a classification apparatus. Well, you know, and we've got a couple of folks sort of wandering out that are working on declassification and public access, but we need to have more of those that are fighting that same kind of fight so that we have allies on the inside and tools that are helping to do a lot of the work that we're trying to do as well.
If I can just mention something sort of on the outside, so take a step out of government and look at it from the requester community. We had kind of a conversation about this at my office yesterday. I told him I was coming here this morning, and a couple of us sat down. We were kind of bemusing about what it was like 10 years ago compared to what it's like now when you go in and do all of this. Remember that commercial, that Life cereal commercial, you know, I don't want to try it. No, you try it. Well, let's get Mikey to do it. You know, ask Mikey. Well, it used to be that an issue would come up, whether it be state, federal, local, whatever, and we'd be asked to testify, or we'd be asked to submit a letter, or we'd go to a meeting and negotiate things. And the folks, the non-media requesters, sort of the Chamber of Commerce types that were making money off of information, they would say, yeah, when you go in there, why don't you go say this, and why do you say that? It's like, well, why don't you say it? Well, they don't like us. It's like, oh, yeah, because they love us. It was, yeah, but, you know, the Driver's Privacy Protection Act back in, what was that, 92, 93, the folks who were making money off of car records and license plates and all of this stuff, they were just kind of sitting there saying, why don't you go in there and say this? Well, now we're going to have to go back and say to those people, even though they are obviously lobbying on a daily basis, you're going to have to take a slightly more visible role, because guess what? We don't have any money. And we are finding ourselves in the media community reaching out more to those organizations that, quite honestly, we never really wanted to work with all that much because we were covering them. There are some conflict of interest issues there. You always kind of wanted to have some distance there because of ethical reasons. And now we're finding out that we're having to do more and more bridge building all the time. And it gives my steering committee members some pretty substantial indigestion, but we quite honestly don't know what else to do.
I'm not sure where to start. Daniel laid out one way. The suggestion I made was that maybe OpenTheGovernment.org should take a first crack at it, and we as a community should start to create a barometer of what we mean by open government spending. Someone should start somewhere is the bottom line. But I also wasn't suggesting that we have a line item called open government. I think Daniel's story about the e-government fund is a real indicator of the dangers of putting everything under a line item and causing a difficult political fight that you may or may lose, may win, may lose. So I'm not convinced on that. The last thing I would comment is the other area where I think we are not very strong as a community. I don't think we have very good assessment data about the effectiveness of the transparency itself. I'm thinking about putting out, we put a lot of energy, many of us, into financial regulatory disclosure. We've done nutrition disclosure. We have done environmental workplace hazard communication. We need better jobs of assessing the benefits that derive from that. I think there are those benefits, but it also is a way of bringing in different constituencies into our struggle of openness and making a more powerful base before our legislative bodies.
If I can make just one comment on that, the one thing I would caution, yes, I think it is important to have a better understanding of the efficacy of it to help us make our case, but we never want to be in a position of saying, well, transparency in this case didn't have any measurable benefits that we can think of, therefore let's default to non-transparency. The default in a democratic government should be transparency, and if the case is going to be made for secrecy, then tell us why secrecy is more efficacious in that particular case. So I guess I just want to caution against putting too much weight on what are the tangible benefits of transparency. It ought to be the default, no matter what.
Okay. Jim?
So my question relates to the framing of cost expenditures, how we frame it. Some people have suggested alternative frames. What's clearer is when you talk to politicians and administrators, they frame all open government initiatives as, oh, it's going to cost us money. We love open government, but we can't afford it. That's the popular framing. So Elizabeth suggested a clever alternative. It's not can we afford to make government open, but can we afford not to. But I think that actually buys into the politician's framing of the issue. I think often the case can be made that good open government saves money. I'll give three quick examples. We spent a fortune in the United States on public and legal notices in newspapers and whatnot. The Annenberg School has estimated close to 10% of local newspaper revenues, including the Wall Street Journal and whatnot, are from these legal notices. Now, the press lobby loves this, and they're an important part of the Open Government Coalition, but A, they do an awful job of providing public notice for public meetings, and B, there are far more cost-effective ways to do a much better job. So that's one example. You can save huge amounts of money, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, to do a much better job. But this community has not addressed that type of issue. Video coverage. You know, FACA, I've seen the FACA Advisory Committee say costs them $300 an hour to do webcasting. Well, it should be. You push a button, and it should cost basically zero marginal costs. To webcast meetings. You could save a lot of money and do an infinitely better job than they're currently doing with, you know, automated index meetings. You know, another example, FOIA requests. It's unbelievable. They'll spend thousands and thousands of dollars of legal attorneys going back and forth in appeals for things like getting waivers on ethics disclosures, which clearly are public information, but they're going to play every game and spend a fortune. You could save a lot of money in this $400 million FOIA thing if they wanted to do it. And this relates to the last question about PR. We spent a fortune, and there's no budget item for PR because that's an embarrassing item. Nobody would ever call it, but, you know, incredible amounts. Every member of Congress has at least one PR staff. Senators have multiple. That's just the tip of the iceberg of PR expenditures. And if if you thought in terms of these very concrete examples. We spend so much money on these things because politicians want control. I mean, video coverage is so unbelievably inefficient and expensive the way you do it, because politicians want control. They don't want to design an efficient system. These are really PR budgets rather than open government budgets. So I would encourage you, when you think about your metrics, think in very specific areas. And if you have any feedback on whether this is an appropriate framing, it's certainly the waste, fraud, and abuse, or whatever it is, on open government expenditures is just not the way we've framed it. But what do you think about this as at least an element of how we should frame the issues?
So thoughts on the frame to put around advocating for open government?
If I could respond to a piece of what you said, I do think that if transparency were the norm and the default, it would be a lot cheaper than it is. I think one of the reasons why transparency is sometimes expensive and inefficient is because special procedures and measures have to be put in place to create measures for secrecy, for transparency in situations where secrecy is the default. And that just changes the dynamic. It changes the expense that goes into it. And the example that I can think of is when I was in Guantanamo this week, I had to pay $150 in cash, had to be cash, for internet access. Now, all of the soldiers down there had wireless, but I was not allowed to use that wireless. I had to pay $150 in cash because the presumption going down there was I had no right to communicate with the rest of the world while I was there. So this was a special measure, and I had to pay for it through the nose. I mean, transparency, I really think that arguing about whether transparency is done efficiently or inefficiently is kind of a later argument for when we have more transparency, and then it will be more important to focus on whether we're doing it as efficiently as we can. I think right now it's not sort of the main issue, but it is certainly an indicator of the fact that it is not the default in many areas.
Andy, do you have a question, or are you here to announce lunch?
What I wanted to do, certainly the latter, what I wanted to do was thank the panel. I hope everyone else will join me in thanking the panel.